folks, Don Higgins. I'm the president and founder of Real World Wildlife Products, and I want to invite you to our Whitetail Management Conference to be held February 25th and 26th in Arthur, Illinois. We've got a great lineup of speakers, including Dr. Aaron Gaines, Dr. Clifford Shipley, myself, and a handful of others. We'll also have a handful of vendors on site. It'll be a great opportunity for you to come and network with some of these folks who work in the whitetail land management industry. This is definitely an event you don't want to miss. All the attendees are going to get one of our new whitetail management handbooks. This handbook has nearly 100 pages of information pertaining to a handful of different land management projects, you know, establishing warm season native grasses, deer nutrition, tree plantings for wildlife, fruit trees, herbicides, fertilizers, various planting methods. This is almost like an encyclopedia for a land manager. Every attendee gets one of these for free. This event is open to real world dealers and their guests. So if you're a real world dealer, we look forward to seeing you there. If you're not, consider signing up to become a dealer. If you have no interest in that, maybe get a local business to sign up and you can come as their guest. But guarantee you're going to learn something about managing for whitetails at this conference. Hope to see you there.
Chasing Giants with Don Higgins and Terry Peer. Brought to you by Osseo Camo, nature's most lethal camouflage. Follow along as Don and Terry discuss the techniques, strategies, and dedication needed to harvest one of God's most amazing creations, world-class whitetails.
Hey guys, this is Terry from Chasing Giants. Thanks for tuning in to this episode. You know, we've been talking about our event at 360, and we were so humbled to get to travel to East Pennsylvania and sit down with all of the dealers from 360 Blinds and do a live podcast. Well, this show is straight from there. We took listener-submitted questions, some of them about hunting, some of them not. Some great questions. I know you'll be engaged in this episode. It's a little bit different, but we're going to jump right in as Don starts telling the story about how he met Mark Fisher and tried to buy the company. Yes, Don Higgins, when we first met 360, it was because Don liked the blind so much he wanted to buy it. So we're so blessed that Mark kept it and grew it into what it was today. We're so happy to be partners with him. But I hope you stay tuned and watch this episode. It's got some great questions that come live from the audience. Thanks for joining us. We're going to be wearing these headphones, so we pretty much can't hear you all if you want to get up and move around or whatever you need to do. So you won't disturb us any. There will be a camera running up here. If you'll notice in the middle of the table, there's a deck of cards. So to keep people to get embarrassed about coming up and answering questions and having their voice or their picture on film, it's a whole lot easier if you guys just write a question. Nothing is off limits for Don. Okay, you can ask about hunting, food plots, religion, marital advice. We've got a couple couples here. So he offers his advice free of charge, but is not liable. So there is a mutual indemnification clause that has to be signed for any marital advice. James Hayden. Well, James Hayden, please, if you're a real world dealer, you know James. James is our sales manager. He came to us from Dove. So you know the soap company. So James was a hand and finger model before he came to us. So as you meet him tonight and you shake his hand, make sure you look at how soft and just fabulous his hands and fingernails look. So James, thanks for being here. I'm just kidding. So there you go. When you have a question, James is going to be in the back. Merle, can you help out a little bit? Some of the guys from 360, write you a question and just hold it straight up and somebody will go get it, bring it up to me, and we'll discuss it. So if we have to ad-lib an hour of this podcast, it's going to be really boring. So please ask questions, okay? Everybody cool with that? Who's been to a live podcast before by us? Wow, okay. Not many of you. So figure out some questions, write it out. As soon as you have that, just hold it up in the air. Somebody will get it, bring it up to us, and we'll put Don on the spot. Any questions? We've never had a podcast where food was served in the middle of it, so I'll be a little bit honest. I'm worried that everybody's going to leave, but we'll work through it. No, I'm just kidding. Help yourself move around. You won't bother us one bit, and we hope you enjoy the show, okay?
Terry, teammates that like read my stuff is that I've always got real life examples to prove what I'm saying.
There's a lot of good people that listen to this podcast.
You know, other than God and my family, they're only with me next in line when I live in the priority.
From the bottom of our hearts, it's just fantastic and awesome to have the support that you guys are
taking. People ask me about his family brought in and love sleeps.
Chasing Giants with Don Higgins and Terry Beer. Brought to you by Osseo Camo, nature's most lethal camouflage. Follow along as Don and Terry discuss the techniques, strategies, and dedication needed to harvest one of God's most amazing creations, world-class whitetails.
Well, the time has finally come, a live podcast in front of all of our good friends at 360. We are in East Pennsylvania, Don, in front of some of our closest friends.
We are. A lot of these guys are also real-world dealers, so kind of familiar with a lot of them.
And we're going to talk a little bit in this opening segment. Folks, you know every week of the Chasing Giants podcast, we have what's called the Higgins Hot Seat, where I give Don a question that he does not know what it is. Sometimes it's related to hunting, sometimes it's not. But this whole episode is the Higgins Hot Seat. So all of the listeners that are in the room are writing out some questions. We don't know what they're going to be that Don has to off the cuff come up with an answer. We know what the political questions are going to be most of the time, but you never know what comes out of your mouth. And we are fully aware that somebody in the room is going to poke the bear with probably a Venezuela or Hillary question. It's going to happen, so don't be scared. Let her have it, okay? But I want to circle back around a little bit. There's a couple things that we want to talk about why people are writing out their questions. First of all, our relationship with 360, and this goes back many years. And I was able to come to this exact room last year and talk a little bit about some marketing ideas and brand strategies. A lot of the dealers were here, some of them very experienced dealers, some of them brand new, and got to talk with them. But this year we're both here doing a live podcast, and I want you to tell a story. But before you tell that story, I think it's really important for me to just tell the people in the room how special this organization is. Number one, if you were here last year, you got to listen to a story about how Mark Fisher started this thing in his garage. And in everything he did, his goal was to put God first. And that's the exact methodology and strategy that Don and I have tried to do. So we are extremely humbled and proud to see a partner that we call a friend. We call you a friend more than a partner, Mark, but that his heart is in the right place and he is being blessed by him focusing everything he can for the kingdom. And I want you all to know how special that is. Not only with Mark and Merle and the rest of the team back over here, I think we got a lot of the guys from 360 here that you should be proud of what you do when you go to work every day. But also as it gets down with the distributors and then finally to you dealers. You know, I was talking to Ed. Ed's one of the distributors at the ATA show just a couple days ago. And I talk and will communicate with all kinds of companies all over the country. What you all have with this culture, with Mark and the leadership of 360, with the distributors that are at the top, and then you dealers coming together, talking, networking, finding ways to run your business and be successful all together. This company, this room, the people involved here is special. We don't get to see that every time. So you all ought to be proud and thank Mark for the leadership and the organization that that he's put together. Let's take a minute and just give that guy a round of applause. Wonderful job building your business. We're proud of you. We're honored to call you a friend. And you guys are going to get a kick out of this story about how Don and I first met Mark.
Yeah, so it's probably been 10 years ago now. I was at a show in Ohio, and it was the first show that Mark Fisher was ever at with his 360 hunting blinds. And you know, I remember I was there in a booth for Real World Wildlife Products, and this nice-looking young Amish man comes up to me, and he wants to show me his blind, that his hunting blind that he made and was selling. And I thought, yeah, I'm doing this guy a favor. I'm going to go look at his blind. But I went over there and I was very impressed with his blind. In fact, I was so impressed, I went back 3 or 4 times that weekend to check that blind out. And I told my business partner at the time that these are the nicest blinds on the market. We need to try to buy this company. And so short time after that event, I contacted Mark to see if he would sell us 360 Onion blinds. And I don't know, we went back and forth a couple phone calls. It didn't take long, and he turned it down. And it's probably a good thing he did, because I could have never done with it what he's done. I just had too many irons in the fire already. But got to know Mark through that first meeting and a series of phone calls and such. He's actually been to my house. He shot a buck on my farm out of a 360 blind. But the next summer after I met Mark that winter, I was actually selling a different brand of hunting blinds and had several of them on my farm. And I decided to take all them down, sell them, and convert to 360 on my farm. And so Ed Weaver shows up, and him and I are putting these blinds up across my farm. And we're in one particular location, and I knew that I had a 200-inch buck on my farm that summer. And as Ed and I are putting that blind up, I told Ed, I said, I'm going to shoot a 200-inch buck out of this blind this fall. And as we're putting that blind together on the side, and I think Ed kind of scoffs at me. He didn't know whether to believe me or not, but he did go back and he told Mark what I said. And Mark contacts me and he says, if you shoot a 200-inch buck out of one of my blinds this fall, I'll give you a free blind. Well, that fall, I shot a 200-inch buck out of that blind, and Mark made good on his word and sent me a free blind. So, and like I said, that's a decade ago. I shot that buck in 2017, and I'd met Mark, the fall before, so 2016. So it's been exactly 10 years since that happened. But the more I get to know Mark and his whole team, the more impressed I am, the more respect I have for him. So he runs his company very similar to how we run Real World Wildlife Products. And, he recognizes that you guys are the foundation of his business. You guys are what makes it run. And we recognize the same with Real World. So appreciate all you guys coming out, and that's how the relationship started with Mark and us.
Yeah, I think we just answered the first question that somebody submitted, so we got that out of the way. But yeah, it's the relationship keeps continuing to grow. I think out on a trailer outside the conference center right now is a Chasing Giants Osseo 360 blind. I'm not sure whose that is or why it's out there, but every time I see one of those in person, I just think back over the last 10 years and the relationship that we've built with Mark, and how much that friendship, I'm blessed to have a lot of business acquaintances in the industry that are devout Christians. And when my dad and I were considering talking about starting the religious podcast, Chasing Assurance, Mark and I actually talked about that. He gave me some advice and, whether we should do it. And, from a guy that, do you still put the Book of John? Yeah, so even a guy who puts the Book of John in every dealership order, that maybe one day somebody's going to learn about Jesus through his business, it makes everything else worth it. So to work with a company who just wants to make heaven crowded, that's a pretty cool goal for all of us when we're doing our business. So as time's gone on, I've got to be on conference calls and get to meet guys like Curtis. I think the world of Curtis. He runs a very successful business. Listening to him talk, I get to learn stuff from him. And obviously, me and Ed get to poke each other a little bit about camo patterns every once in a while. Have you switched yet? No, he still hasn't switched yet. But it's still a good time to get to see these guys out in the trade show. So thank you very much for us being here. But we really appreciate that. Let's dive in a little bit before we start answering questions. Don, there's another very interesting fact about this night in this room. And both of our wives are here. And we don't think there's been another time when both of our wives have watched us do a podcast before. So that's kind of awkward.
Should we have them stand up and everybody give them a round of applause?
Yeah, let's have the wives stand up and say hello. Everybody turn around. My wife, Casey, on the left, and Robin on the right. Hey! We're in the other room a lot while we're recording. That happens a lot, but I don't know outside of when we did a live Luster's Feet event that those two have been in the room. So we could even have people ask questions to the wives, yeah. And James could come up and get this cordless mic and take it back there, and they could answer too. So when we say nothing's off limits, guys. But we had our wives. We had a lot of travel time here with this road trip to get out to East Pennsylvania. So both of our wives kept us company as we were driving. We appreciate them and their support. They put up with a lot with us.
They do, but the look Robin's giving me, I think I'm sleeping in the truck tonight. She has to answer the question.
You might like answering the question. It might be one that you could poke the bear, Robin. And she's just rolling her eyes at me, too. I think I'm in the doghouse. We'll be sleeping in the shed next time I'm up there. So let's talk a little bit about consulting. Make sure you're asking your questions. I don't have enough up here to get us through the whole show, but finish asking your questions on your note card and raise them up so we can get them. Talk a little bit about maybe the property you were on here just yesterday.
Yeah, I was in Maryland, of all places, on the Chesapeake Bay looking at a property. And, you know, it's not a whole lot different. The terrain's not a whole lot different than the Midwest, except for the fact that there's 10 zillion geese in every field.
Really?
I'm telling you, I've never seen so many geese.
I thought my turkeys were bad.
They don't outnumber the geese, I promise you.
Wow. So what's a solution for that? If somebody's dealing with that much waterfall coming in, I'm sure that there's either crop damage or worried about seed. Is it Canada geese, or is it?
Yeah, it's Canada geese.
So they don't migrate, I don't think, anymore, do they? Do they stay there the whole time?
I think they do to some degree, but nothing like the snow geese.
Yeah. But, man, that could do a damage on somebody trying to put a food plot out, wouldn't it?
Well, the thing of it was, is every ag field had a cover crop of wheat planted in it for the geese. Because, you know, waterfowl hunting is big on the Chesapeake. So the deer have food literally in every single ag field.
Interesting.
Which makes it a challenge to set the property apart. But we got to offer something different than what the deer can find everywhere else.
Yep.
But, waterfowl's king on the Chesapeake.
Yeah. Wonder what a Brenton 22 arc with a suppressor on it from about 600 yards away would do to a Canada goose. I'm asking for a friend. Wow. I'm sure that's against the law.
I have no experience with that. So
you don't want to comment or deny on that?
No.
All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and ask a question here. Don, somebody submitted a question that says, what is the best time to TSI your property to get optimal results for the next season?
Right now. Before spring green up, when the spring green up starts, you want that sunlight coming in, hitting the ground, stimulating that new woody vegetation, weeds, briars, whatever. So do it right now in the winter.
Well, right piggybacked after that one with as far as when is the best time, someone asked a question about hinge cutting, and I know this topic is near and dear to your heart because there's quite a bit of information out there on social media or the internet that you probably don't align with too much. So let's talk a little bit about your philosophy of hinge cutting, where it's good, where it's bad, and then specifically when we're creating bedding areas.
Well, I'm not a big fan of hinge cutting. For the main reason is when you hinge cut a tree, that tree's still alive. The root system's still alive. The top is still alive, still shaking the ground. And if my opinion is if that tree is so worthless that you're going to hinge cut it, why don't you just cut it off and kill it and let something good grow up there? Say it doesn't have a place somewhere. I'm sure it does, but very limited. I think if you don't have a lot of ground cover and you're trying to create some ground cover, you know, having that tree alive makes a little more cover than a top that's deteriorating. But I would say, like on my own property, you know, probably less than 10% of the trees that I'm cutting when I'm enhancing a bedding area, less than 10% are hinge cut. Most are just cut off and allowed to fall. And then I'll come back and I'll spray the stumps to kill the stump on a lot of them, just depending on the species. But just not a big fan of hinge cutting.
So we don't want to necessarily leave that tree living and sucking up nutrients where it would another tree of value would come back in its place. What about like say in hill country? How many guys in the room consider where they're from hill country versus the flat pancake of the Midwest? Raise your hand if you're from hill country. Quite a few. So let's say you got this spine with a ridge in the woods down there, and you got to access at the end, and I want the deer to stay on that spine. Would you use hinge cut to funnel deer and not necessarily create bedding or not?
No, you can. You're going to make me reveal some of our secrets that we do when we...
Intellectual property. Yeah. We will not charge for what he's about to say.
Somebody make a video on it next week.
Probably.
A million hits, yeah. But no, on a ridge top, a lot of times what I like to do is go right down that ridge top, and the trees on one side, you follow them one direction, trees on the other, and you create a travel corridor right down the middle. And then at the end, where that ridge makes a point before it breaks off into a bottom, that's where you create just a cluster of bedding cover, whether it be fallen trees, hinge cut trees, or whatever, because deer like to bed on those points. They can bed out there, and they can watch from multiple directions for danger coming, and if they got the wind at their back, they're covered 360 degrees. Well, when they stand up in the afternoon to leave, they walk right down that ridge, and they're walking right into the wind. So, a lot of times we get into situations where these ridge tops have been cleared for ag fields or whatever, and then there's like fingers off of the main ridge. And I see one habit amongst a lot of land managers is that they want to take those fingers that have been cleared, and they want to make a food plot on them. Well, that can work in certain situations, but what I would prefer to do is make bedding cover out on the point of that ridge and have the food, back towards that main ridge. And get those deer bedded right there by the food source, and makes them a whole lot easier to kill.
And that becomes part of our philosophy of access, because it's so hard to get back in those fingers and not blow deer out when you come back out.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit about what you just said about, that hinge cut technique. There is going to be a very special session at the Midwest Sportsman's Classic this year, which... Did I see Joe's walk in?
I thought I seen Joe's.
So, yep. So, you're going to have 360 blinds at the Ship Shawana show, correct? Yeah. So, one of our top dealers in the country, Cloverleaf, and also a 360 dealer, is going to have a big display at the Ship Shawana show. But at that event, Don and I are actually going to do a breakout session for special projects that were done on both of our home farms to funnel deer closer to 360 hunting blinds. So we're actually going to get up in front of that arena up on the screen and talk about how we were building a stand and camera location to funnel deer. And it's actually going to have real-time video, drone video, and the results that happened after that. And the whole purpose of this was to dump bucks out directly in front of a 360 blind. So if you're at the Midwest Sportsman's Classic, watch for that breakout session. That's going to happen every single day. I was talking to Derek today, and not only is there an art contest and a baking contest where you get to eat your cherry pie, I learned and decided today that Chasing Giants is going to sponsor a trail camera contest where people can bring in their best trail camera pictures and win prizes on that. So much stuff coming for Midwest Sportsman's Classic, and the 360 will obviously be there with some of their preferred dealers as well. Here's an interesting business question for you. We're going to change the pace up a little bit. What is your best advice for a startup company? What's the best lesson you learned?
Well, I can think of a couple right off the top of my head. One, if you want to make a lot of money at a business, your business needs to focus on one of three things. It needs to focus on kids, pets, and hobbies. Because people will spend ridiculous amounts of money on their kids, pets, and hobbies. They'll go to the grocery store and they'll complain about the price of food, and then they'll turn around and, spend $10 on a gallon of purified water for their dog. So, kids, pets, and hobbies. The other thing is... surround yourself with people whose strengths are your weakness. And I've done that with Terry and with the folks at the Real World that's helped that company just explode. Those people all have strengths that are my weaknesses, and I don't micromanage them. I put them in their position and turn them loose and let them run. I think those are two huge keys if you want to make a lot of money in business.
Those demographics of things were, and the only reason is I think there's a lot of people that get in and say, I have an idea. but there's already people in that space. The only way you grow in an existing space is to commoditize it, which means do it cheaper, faster, or better. And that's tough. Mm-hmm. But in that space where it's kids, pets, or hobbies, we always know no matter what the economy is doing, people's going to spend money. And then your job is not only have that niche, but connect the dots to those buyers. So that's the tough part. There's always going to be people spending money in those. It's just how can you get your product to that? And we're probably going to learn about that a little bit later during the marketing and sales presentation. It's all of these 360 dealers. There's some of them sell real world. It's getting their services, their product into the right hands of potential buyers. That's what marketing and sales is all about.
Well, I think it's also important to diversify your business. You don't put all your eggs in one basket because you never know which one is going to fail and which one's going to explode. And you know, for you guys that are dealing in 360 hunting blinds, you know, you diversify into other outdoor products that your same customer base is going to purchase. You know, whether it's food plot seed, mineral, trail cameras, you know, the list goes on and on. The people that buy your 360 hunting blinds, think about the other products that those folks are going to buy and start carrying those products as well. And when they show up, you know, don't make one sale. Have that person returning time after time to buy more product from you.
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking as a grandpa who got to watch his grandson kill a buck on video, we just recorded some of the narrative of your son Walker's hunt on your home farm.
Grandson.
Yep, sorry, grandson and son-in-law. Yep. But somebody asked a question about getting kids involved in hunting and your philosophy or ideas about that.
Well, I think there's a lot of folks that are pushing their kids into not only hunting, but whatever their interest is. And I would just encourage parents to let the child choose their interest. And that's what my parents did with me. I think my parents had no interest in hunting whatsoever. But they would just support my brother and I in whatever it was that our interests were. So I think there's just a lot of kids, you see it on social media especially, that, a 4 or 5 year old kid has just shot this giant buck. Well, that kid doesn't know what he's doing. His dad put him in a blind over a pile of corn and probably aimed the crossbow or the gun for him. And all the kid did was pull the trigger as the dad held the gun. And I think that's a good way for a child to get burnt out and lose interest in hunting in a hurry. I think the kid needs to have the interest first, and then I think he needs to be started slow. He doesn't need to be starting out shooting 170-inch bucks. Let him shoot the first deer that comes along, whether it's a doe or whatever it is. And he doesn't even have to start deer. I mean, start with small game or trapping or whatever. I think when you start them too quick and they're too successful out of the gate, they just lose interest in a hurry.
Gotcha. I'm going to keep bouncing around to different topics as we go here. This person is asking, has your property in Ohio sold yet? And what were some things you learned, pluses and minuses, of the project of developing those properties?
Well, I've moved a lot of properties in Ohio, but I still got two for sale. There's a 75-acre tract and a 383-acre tract that we've bought and developed that we haven't sold yet. Lessons I've learned, I don't know that I've learned that much off of these properties because I just applied lessons that I've learned back home over the last several decades. But if there's anything, it's that, you know, areas get a reputation for either being really good or not so good for deer, and especially for big deer. And I think it's the specific property is way more important than the county or the state or whatever. So there's good properties in about every county, and there's bad properties in about every county. So the specific property is way more important.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about bedding, specifically switchgrass, native grasses. So I'm going through and I have quite a few questions that are talking about kind of the same thing when it's creating, identifying the sanctuary. So let's relate it back to a consulting visit. So you're going into a property that you are basically working with a clean slate, whether it's pasture, ag field, somebody says, turn this whole thing into a recreational property. That's all I have to worry about. Walk us through how you identify where to put the sanctuary, what are you looking for, and then once you identify the area, what are some choices, including and not including native grasses, and how to get those established?
Well, probably the first thing to look for is access. You know, where can you access that property? Does it have multiple access points or one access point? So you got to keep that in mind as you lay it out, because that's how you're going to get into hunt. And, you know, you can't be accessing right through the heart of your sanctuary, for example. So, excuse me. I'd say that's number one, is access. You know how you lay it out? Terrain really plays into that.
We just played the Osseo commercial for a while. That is coughing, coughing in case anybody's watching.
You may have to play it twice. Does that answer the question anymore?
So you said what you're looking for with the sanctuary. Now, how do you implement it? With switchgrass, without switchgrass? What's the options on putting that bedding in?
Well, that depends on what's in the area. You want something that's different than can be found in all the properties nearby. So, you know, if it's in an area that's heavily wooded, you're going to want to provide something different. That's where your grasses come in.
Okay. If, let's say you're in big hill country and you want to put your sanctuary on the side of a hill that you're worried about not being able to burn, what could you do there? Say it was an old grown-up cattle pasture or big woodlot on hillsides.
Well, I don't ever worry about burning. I don't know why everybody.
You're a pyro. That's why.
Yeah.
Robin, how many times has the fire department been called?
Multiple, no doubt about it. I mean, obviously, a deer's not going to bed on a steep hillside. I mean, you're going to look for pinches and you know, flat spots, or maybe not totally flat, but flatter spots where those deer are going to want to bed anyway. You know, land ownership allows us to dictate how deer move on our property to some degree. And on some properties to a great degree. And I think that's one thing that gets lost on a lot of landowners, is they buy a piece of property and they go out there and they start looking for deer signs, deer trails, whatever. And, you know, they're trying to hunt what the deer are doing today. Well, when we go in to consult on a property, we pay attention to what they're doing today, but we're looking at terrain features and things like that that we can dictate. That movement, and we can make them move where we want them to instead of where they want to, and, you know, make it a whole lot more conducive to hunting, at least hunting successfully when you play the wind and such.
This person asked, do you come to owner's property to evaluate what to do to make them better areas? So why don't you talk a little bit about the team of consultants and your services that you offer through Chasing Giants?
Yeah, so, you know, we got a consulting service. There's actually six of us. Seven, actually got me, six besides me, all over the country. Terry's one of them. We got Wes Delks, Derek Burkholder, David Elliott, Bobby Worthington, and Caleb Gaiman, who's on the East Coast. So, you know, we cover the country. We meet with landowners all the time. I'm probably going to meet with about 60 this winter. But our group will do typically about 300 properties a winter, and that number seems to be growing each year.
Yeah. All right, this is going to be interesting. I bet Mark Fisher and Merle Fisher's ears perk up a little bit with this question, but it relates right back to 360. And the first one is, with all of the copycat blinds out there, what makes the 360 blind set apart from the others you have seen? I think sales tips here.
Well, the window system is hands down the best out there. It's been copied, but I've never seen anyone top it with something better. The window, not only the window itself, but, you know, the fact that it's surrounded by windows, that you can sit in the middle of that blind and you don't have to move your chair and your head continually look out one window or another. All you got to do, it's almost like sitting in a tree stand. And I think that's the big selling point when I talk about the attempt I made to buy the company back when it started. That's what caught my eye was the fact that when I sit in that blind in that show in Ohio, I recognized right out of the gate that I could not have to move my chair, and I could see out every window very easily, and also the those windows. So in the blind I was selling before, if two windows were lined up, you know, from the outside, and there was someone sitting there, you would see them, that person. But the 360 windows are dark enough that the deer just don't see in.
All right, so continuing with that theme, someone is asking here for the suggestion box for Mark. If you could change one thing about 360 blinds, what would it be? He's looking over here. He's peering at you.
I think they all should come in. I think he should just do away with all of them except the Osseo Camo Chasing Giants blind. That should be the only one he sells from here on out. Good luck for that one.
good luck, right? Here's something that I think, if you guys aren't, raise your hand in the room if you're above 6 foot tall. If you're 6'1 or higher, raise your hand in the room. One of the things that I noticed is, as I've gotten older, fatter, and more out of shape, I can't sit still very long. So part of the plus about me being a blind is when my back starts hurting, I can stand up and stretch my legs inside of 360. Almost every other blind on the market does not have that little peephole window around the top. And so what do you do when you're trying to get up and stretch your legs? You're bent over trying to see out the window every now and then. And guys, if you have people come into your lots looking at your display model, and you see when you look at them that they're over 6 foot tall, you got to point that out as a big selling feature, because that immediately separates you away from everything else that, you know, especially if they got a little, belly on them, or maybe they can't walk real fast like me across the parking lot, you know they probably got a bad back. So make sure you're pointing out that spec to them. Let's go back to a switchgrass field here. Somebody said they planted switchgrass last year and it was overgrown with foxtail. What would you recommend doing? Burning, herbicide, what all?
You need to burn it this year in early spring. Quinclorac is a herbicide that will take care of foxtail and not hurt your switchgrass, but it's got to be sprayed and that foxtail is really small. That foxtail you had last year is all gone to seed. But it doesn't grow so well unless the ground is disturbed. So when you get a good crop of foxtail, that crop is going to get less and less every year. It came up because of the ground being disturbed. But still, you're going to have some, and that's when you burn it off, get rid of all that thatch and everything that's there. And then this year, let those grasses get up about 12 inches tall and spray them with quinclorac. I would also throw in 2,4-D at the same time. And if you've got any broadleafs coming on, that'll take care of both the foxtail and the broadleaf weeds.
All right. Would you do the same thing for miscanthus? Is there any different approach with miscanthus?
Same thing.
Okay. All right. So I'm going through these. This one says they want to know what our dream hunts are, whether you're in the, I think this is hot seat with a bow in hand, or your grandson, family, friend, whitetail, or any animal. I think it just means what's the bucket list hunts at this point in your life. Kill a 5,200-inch bug.
Yeah, there you go. The older I get, the more I like sleeping in my own bed. So traveling around hunting has lost its appeal over the years. So I would like to go, and I've said this on the podcast before, I would like to go to Texas, charter a bus with a bunch of friends, and just go to a ranch in Texas and spend a week there eating really good food and spending time with friends and hunting whatever. I don't even care what it is. It'd be pigs, and I'd be happy.
Okay. Let's switch gears and talk about herbicides and non-GMO seeds. Do you think that there's a tie to herbicides, GMO versus non-GMO, and the effect and attractiveness on whitetails?
Absolutely. Without a doubt, a deer can detect a non-GMO from a GMO. GMO means genetically modified organism. And they prefer the non-GMO, hands down. Now, I also think that they can detect some herbicide applications. For example, in list soybeans, you can spray Liberty, you can spray glyphosate, and you can spray 2,4-D on those. And I think some heavier doses or rates of those chemicals can render those beans less palatable, and deer just don't like them as well.
Okay. This one says, in your opinion, what is there more of in the world, wheels or doors?
Wheels or doors?
I don't know. You could probably say either one of them. I don't know how you're going to quantify
it. I'll say wheels.
More wheels than doors in there. All right. I got myself out of order here. What would you look for when buying a hunting property to manage for hunting?
What lays around it? What lays around it's way more important than what's on the property. You can change what's on the property. If it needs food, you clear some blocks. If it needs cover, you plant some switchgrass. But you cannot change what's around that property. You're stuck with whatever it is. You can take a 5-acre property with not a single tree on it. If it sits right next to a 1,000-acre sanctuary, you put food on it, surround it with miscanthus, you're going to shoot a bunch of deer. What surrounds the property is way more important than what's on the property.
Okay. What is the smallest and largest property you've ever consulted on?
Well, the smallest is 8 acres. That was in Michigan a few years ago. And I just did a 10-acre property about a week ago in Ohio. Biggest, I did several over 1,000 acres. I think probably the biggest
project in Mississippi was big, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. But I think I've got 3 or 4 this year that are over 1,000 acres. So I don't know, probably pushing 2,000 acres would be the biggest.
Okay. What has deer hunting done for you or taught you that you have taken with you through your life outside of the woods?
Well, I've said many times the best thing that deer hunting ever did for me was the people that I met through deer hunting. I've met a lot of good people. I think it's those relationships that are way more important than the deer we shoot. So. But without a doubt, I think the people is the best thing that deer hunting ever did for me.
Yeah, I agree. Believe it or not, it all started with
me trying to figure out how to make a little money at a side hustle. And did I lose audio? I think I got a bad wire here. Test.
There you go. It came back.
There we go.
My plug came out. It's given me a crazy big platform to talk about Jesus. And I would have never, I come from a family of ministers, and I went through a phase in my life with fell into that trap where Satan had me very jaded against the church because I always looked at it as my dad's employer versus where I go to for the right reasons to get closer to God. And so I was very anti-following in the family's footsteps with being a minister. And here God laughed at me and said, I'm going to give you a bigger platform to begin with either. Are you going to use it or not? So I look back over the last 5 years we've been doing this and the amount of people that we've been able to talk to and show that we're two idiots that fail every day and sin every day, but that we're saved by the grace of God. I would have never been able to do that if it wasn't for deer hunting.
Yep, great answer.
So, all right, we got just a couple more minutes. I'm not going to be able to get through all of these, but this is an interesting question. Somebody, this is a 360 dealer asking this question. He says, I had a customer ask me, when I opened my welcome packet for 360, there was brochures for Real World Wildlife products in it, but you sell a different brand in your showroom. They asked me what I should buy. Are all 360 dealers also Real World Wildlife dealers?
No, they're not, but I wish they were. we'll help get you set up. James is back here that he'd be glad to talk to you. We got an event similar to this coming up in February. We'd love to have you there. You can learn more about us. But we value the partnership that we have with Mark. Like Terry said, he's become a friend, and the whole 360 team, the distributors and the dealers. A lot of 360 dealers became 360 dealers through their relationship with us in Real World and vice versa. I just think that we need to use our platform to help each other instead of being competitive with each other. We can share ideas. That's what this event is for. And help each other build our businesses instead of thinking that we got to compete all the time. And, you know, I don't see any of our sponsors as being competitors. And even really, some, there's friends in the seat, in the food plot seat business that we are on great terms with. And even though we're selling, you know, competing products, we don't take it personal and we look at them as friends.
Yeah. There's two questions that just came in, and I'm going to take the liberty of answering them. But they were questions about dealing with neighbors and how to deal with that. And I'm, if you listen to our podcast, you already know how he's probably going to. But I want to give you a preview of something. Wes Delks is going to do a seminar in Shipshawana about the mental aspect of hunting. Basically, you know, you guys are all hunters. You know the grind of when things are going really bad, you get down. Wes, for as young as that man is, I've never seen anybody stay more positive and focus on keeping other people positive, because it's just random. I'll get a text, keep grinding, you got this, it's going to happen. But he's going to give a presentation in Shipshawana that he's really nervous about. He told me this on the phone today. He's really nervous about it, but it's going to actually go through examples about how a positive attitude have made the difference, not only in killing a deer, but also even dealing with neighbors setting his property line. And it's just phenomenal to see the young man. He's far above his years in so many different things in his life, not just deer hunting. But I'm really excited. I'm going to skip out of our booth when it comes time for that seminar and actually go listen. And I'm sure he'll do a good job.
Yeah, Wes has held our feet to the fire, and you know, he's young enough to be my son, and yet I feel like God put him in my life at just a perfect time where I needed it. I went through a situation that was not the most pleasant with somebody who was a good friend at that time, and I was having some thoughts of taking matters into my own hands and doing things that a Christian shouldn't. Wes talked me off the ledge more than once, and he's been a positive influence for sure.
I do not think Wes would answer, "What do I do about the neighbor's loose dog?" the same way you would answer it. So that tells you the type of guy that Wes is. Somebody wants to know about have you started any new books? Do you have any plans on it?
Well, that's a good question. Actually, Wes started a book. He was going to do, started a book on me, of all things. He came and interviewed me and my parents, and sent it to me last summer to edit for accuracy. I started doing it, and then I didn't save my changes, and my computer shut down, and I got disgusted, and I never went back. But maybe that's my summer project for this year. I've talked about, you know, probably the final thing that I want to do as far as the hunting industry is a tell-all book. Because if I tell it all, it's going to close more doors than it'll ever open. But there's just some great people in the hunting industry. This room is full of great people. But there's just a handful in this industry that are just so lost that I'm trying to get better at, you know, turning the other cheek, ignoring some of that stuff, reaching out to them in a positive way. But all I can say is it's a good thing I didn't deal with some of these people about 20 years ago when I was younger, because it would have been a struggle. So, you know, I sit up here, and I hope nobody thinks that I look down on anyone, because I sure don't. God didn't make me any better than he made anyone else. I just try to use my platform to help others, and it just gets frustrating when you're trying to help people, and then you get these people that try to destroy you in the process.
All right, well, we're running short on time. We have a hard stop that we have to make because of the program that we have following us tonight. But I got a couple questions to finish up with that will be kind of zingers, real quick answers. Would you ever put a sanctuary on a property line?
Possibly. Depends on what's on the other side of the property.
If a hunter's there.
Not if there's a hunter there.
All right. What's the most important thing to focus on after a hunting property has been decimated with EHD?
That's a great time to do habitat projects that you could never do when you got a lot of deer there. An example on my farm, years ago, before I had a lot of deer on the property, I went and planted a bunch of white pine seedlings. If I do that today, they would get ate to the ground within the first week after they were planted. But there were so few deer on the place that I got away with it back then. And that's a good time to go in and just totally remake your farm and then get out and let the herd recover and let the projects that you do, take shape.
Okay. Somebody asked, do you prescribe fire before doing TSI? Do you think the deer will live in switchgrass? I think that's two separate questions. What about prescribe fire before TSI, yes or no?
I'm not a big fan of fire in the woods. I think it can really cut down on the understory. I was on a property in Missouri that I'll never forget it several years ago on a consulting visit, and I was driving down this ridge top on side by side with the client, and one side of that trail was just wide open timber. There was no ground cover whatsoever, and the other side was just thick as can be. And I mean, it was so drastically different from one side to the other, it really caught my eye. So the first thing I did was I looked up at the treetops. I thought, well, this side with the thick cover, it's got to be open canopy, and that's why the sunlight coming in is why it's so much thicker. But I looked up and the canopy was no different on either side. And so I asked the client, I said, I can't figure out why this side is so much thicker than that side. And he said, well, my local biologist for the Missouri Department of Conservation is a turkey nut, and he wants open timber for the turkey. So he comes in every spring and he does a prescribed burn, and this trail that we're on is the fire break. He comes down this trail with a leaf blower and blows all the leaves off of it, and he always burns this side. Well, that was just an example of why I do not want a fire, because that fire killed all that young vegetation, that regrowth of briars, weeds, tree saplings, whatever, and it kept that timber wide open. Without a doubt, the best deer cover was on the other side that never got burned.
Yeah. So the bird people love us doing that prescribed fire, but it really sets a property back as far as the undergrowth and woody browse that we see so many deer.
I do think that a fire's got its place, though, and I was talking to someone about this earlier. If you've got a place where the cedar trees are really thick, and they've gotten so thick that the wildlife, and especially the deer, are not utilizing them, go in and cut all those cedars. Just let them lay wherever they fall. Let them lay for about a year, and then come back and burn that area and burn up those cedars, and it'll regenerate into some great cover. So it does have its place, but very seldom do I prescribe it in any of my plans.
You do like to burn, though.
Oh, I'll burn anything after all. And she set stuff in the garage just for me to set fires.
Well, let's finish up with this question, because based on a press release and a recent announcement that we did with a partnership with Boone Brothers, but also the impact it's had on your farm the last few days. So take about 6 minutes, 7 minutes here, however long you need, but to talk about how to get more people excited or interested into taking more does, female deer.
Well, the example that I use is what's happened on my farm over the past couple of years. So last year, I shot more than double the number of does I'd ever shot before, and I don't have a super abundance like a lot of people do, but I tried to get things under control, and I probably went just a little bit overboard. And this year, the buck activity, the daylight buck activity, was way more than it ever had been. The rut sign, especially scrapes, was way more prevalent than I'd ever seen. On the negative side, just about every buck on my farm has busted antlers. They fought so much. And just the competition. Another negative is I think the bucks on my farm wandered off of the farm more than they typically had in the past in search of does. So there's a fine line there, balancing your doe herd with the property that you have. But, having too many does is a detriment as well. The bucks don't have to get on their feet and search as much. So they're not near as vulnerable during the rut to hunting pressure. But finding that balance is key.
you know, when I talk to people around Kentucky where we're dealing with huge numbers of does, one of the moral dilemmas they have is they want to shoot more does, but what do I do with them? You can't physically put that many deer in the freezer. You can't, you know, just leave them lay. I know some people do, but I can't morally just kill something and leave it lay for the sake of killing it. If you have not heard our recent announcement that we're partnering with another nonprofit called Boone Brothers out of the state of Kentucky that is operating in the state of Kentucky right now, but it's coming, and a lot of your home states are going to be very quickly on the short list of states to move into. And basically what happens is when you kill a deer, you can take it to a local processor and say, I want to donate it to Boone Brothers. You will be charged nothing. The processor gets paid for cutting up that deer. It goes to another facility, an Amish facility in central Kentucky, and gets turned into Boone Bites, which is a self-stable, shelf-stable jerky that is used in backpack programs and schools to feed hungry kids whose parents don't feed them when they're away from school. So we are actively pushing, connecting. The amount of people that have reached out to us in the last 2 weeks that say we want to help in our state, this thing is going to go much faster than I think the leaders of this organization believe. But basically what it's going to allow you to do is manage and ethically take more deer where you need to off your farm. When your freezer's full, you take it to a processor. The processor gets paid. You don't get paid, and we feed a hungry kid. And I don't know what better way God could use the opportunity of hunting to take care of widows and orphans. I mean, we're called to do that in the Bible. And Jesus said, I was hungry, you fed me. So we're going to be continually, I got a video shoot on Thursday this week where we got to do some video promotional stuff for Boone Brothers. So you'll be hearing more about this, but states like Pennsylvania, Indiana, Missouri, Oklahoma, those states are on the short list of states that this is going to be rolled out to. So you'll be able to help feed hungry kids for shooting some does off your farm. I don't know what else should get you fired up about that. You improve your buck herd and you feed a hungry kid. I don't know what more you could ask for out of a decision to take a doe. So with that, why don't you sign us off here? We got a full action-packed rest of the evening with our friends at 360. You can sign us off, and we'll be back next week. We're both going to be on the road. I'm going to be in South Texas, I believe, and you're going to be consulting in some state out in the Midwest. So
probably Kansas.
Probably Kansas. Yeah, so.
Anyway, I appreciate everyone making it out to the event. Look forward to visiting with you in the next couple of days. And stay tuned next week for another episode of Chasing Giants. God bless.
Chasing Giants has been brought to you by Osseo Camo. Thanks for listening, and tune in next week for another episode of Chasing Giants.
Howdy, Chasing Giants family. Today I got done with a consulting visit, and I was headed back to a hotel, and I came to the revelation that the same things that I'm teaching my toddler, the same thing that I'm teaching my kids, are the same things that I'm working on. And I have a list here written that says truth for toddlers. And these are the things that we are working on with our boys. And they're, no matter what your age is, whether you're 2 years old or 52 years old, there's four things here on my truth for toddlers list of things that we can be working on. The first one is you can't always choose your circumstances, but you can choose your attitude. As a parent, we're preaching a lot of things to our kids, and you realize that you're not just preaching to your kids, but you're preaching to yourself oftentimes. And this is one that really struck me. Colossians 3:2 says, set your mind on things from above, not on things of this earth. And a toddler gets pretty whiny pretty quickly, but how often do we have bad attitudes when it can be something as simple as, I haven't got my target buck's picture for a couple weeks, is he dead? Or some cows from the neighbor got out and they're in my food plot. You can't always choose your circumstances, but you can choose your attitude. Number two, share with your brother. I've got two boys, Ben Boone and William Crockett, and Ben seems to always want the toy that Will has. Philippians 2:3 says, "Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, but in humility consider others above yourself, not looking out for your own interest, but for the interest of others." Share with your brother. Number three, obey. That's it. Pretty simple, obey. And from an earthly perspective, working with my kids, Proverbs 6:20 says, "Keep your father's commands and do not forsake your mother's teachings." As adults, I still am obedient to my parents, to employers, to the government in some circumstances. We're still obedient, but more importantly to our Heavenly Father's commands. John 14:15 says, "If you love me, you will keep my commandments." Our commands is the Bible, what we read in God's rule book, that we're searching the Bible for what we should and should not be doing. And truth number four for toddlers is, you can't steal my joy. Psalms 118:24 says, "This is the day that the Lord has made. I will rejoice and be glad in it." I think we're supposed to have hearts of gratitude and thankfulness and joy. And if you have breath in your lungs, if you've got Jesus in your heart, you have a reason to be joyful today. So that is my truth for toddlers. I want to say a prayer specifically for all the dads. Heavenly Father, we thank you for the day that the Lord has made. We will rejoice and be glad in it. I thank you for our children and the blessing that they are. They are our inheritance. They are our reward. And even when they are difficult, they are still a blessing. I pray that whether the people that are listening to this, whether their kids are 30 years old or 3 years old, that we still strive to be an example for our children, that we lead our kids the way that Christ would want us to. Give us the strength to live lives of faith and not fear, and be boldness, and just do good works in Jesus' name. Give us the wisdom to instruct our children the way that you want us to, with kindness, but with strength at the same time. Just strengthen the dads, the parents that are listening to us. Help us to be just empowered by you. In your son's name we pray. Amen. Have a great week.